Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing great, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. First, I'd like to thank everybody for all the support for my last Peripheral episode. For those of you not in the know, I interviewed the captain from True Crime Garage. Go listen to my Peripheral. When you go search for it, it's got my face on the logo. There's other podcasts with the same name. People have asked what we listen to, Aaron.
Oh, yeah. They ask all the time. And, you know, for a long time, we're just so busy that I wasn't listening to podcasts. And traditionally, I would listen to science podcasts or comedy. But then, you know, being part of this true crime scene and all, I began checking out other podcasts about a year and a half ago. If you do a true crime podcast, there's a chance I may have listened to you now. The last few that I listened to the second episode of Don't Talk to Strangers, which is about the Oakland County child killer case. That's by Nina from Already Gone. That's really, really good. And then I also listened to The Fall Line. I listened to their episodes on the Millbrook twins. I think that's a really, really interesting podcast. And then I also checked out someone I know from social media, really. But I checked out Cambo's podcast, True Crime Island, and I had never listened to a full episode, and I listened to a recent one he put out. Yeah, it's hilarious. What I like about his show is he just verbally goes after people that need going after. So if you ever feel like you want to rage against criminals, then you can do that with Cambo.
The last podcast I listened to was actually a podcast we listened to in your interview on it. I'd been listening to This Is Actually Happening, which is a really cool podcast. I also have checked out Swindled. He did one on the McDonald's coffee spillage lawsuit. That was a interesting one.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Tonight's case is a brutal one. There is a couple warnings I'll give out. There is some animal death in this. There is domestic violence. Just letting you know.
We'll do our best not to be too graphic with the details. Because again, you know, we happen to focus on certain aspects of crimes. And sometimes we do have to get graphic. And in a case like this, we definitely will have to get graphic later on, but it's human on human violence.
Tonight's case is international, so I'm sure a lot of people love that because we're finally getting away from U.S. crime and murder and picking on some other countries. So what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Tonight we're discussing a brutal case out of Australia. It's the Catherine Knight case.
Catherine Knight was... Some people refer to her as the female equivalent of Jeffrey Dahmer. Some people refer to her as the Australian version of Eileen Wuornos. Technically, she only had one murder victim. Although she had many victims over her lifetime, only one of them was murdered. But in one of the most grotesque, horrifying ways you could imagine.
Due to our summary... You already know we're discussing a murderess. I want to take us back to the beginning, where she came from, because there's always that question of, was someone born or made into a killer? And I think as we discuss this case, you'll come to your own conclusion.
Yeah, it's always the nature versus nurture, but no spoiler alert.
There was a couple that lived in Aberdeen, Jack and Barbara Rowan. They had four sons together. Barbara started another relationship because she tired of Jack, apparently. The worker she started a relationship with was Ken Knight. Now, these people all worked in the town of Aberdeen at the Aberdeen Meatworks. It was a slaughterhouse, and it pretty much, everybody that lived there pretty much worked there. And it was that kind of thing where it's kind of like if there was a factory in a town, pretty much everybody worked at the factory. With this other man, she had four more kids, two sons and two daughters. The daughters were fraternal twins. In this case, Joy was born first and then Catherine about a half hour later. When these girls were at a young age, Jack died, Jack Rowan, and he had run this meatworks. So at that point, Barbara had all eight children with her, which, I mean... I can't imagine what kind of a workload that would be. But Ken was a pretty violent guy. He and Barbara would get into it all the time, hitting each other, shouting. This home was described as being beyond dysfunctional. And it was believed that the kids suffered direct abuse as well. Catherine really showed the effects of this when she was at school because she didn't really have friends. While she was at school, other kids tried to bully her. That didn't go down very well with her because she would fight back, and she would fight back by punching these other kids. She never backed down.
This is the thing, is kids back then, they would slap, hit, pull hair, but punching people in the face when you're 4, 5, 8 years old, that's not how those kids fight. You mentioned that her fellow schoolmates would pick on her. They also witnessed a fight she had with her sister where they were arguing over whose turn it was to ride the bike. She was 8 or 9 years old. And this isn't a sibling fight of just beating each other up. This was a full-on vicious war between the two girls. And it was taken notice of because other children, much as they might not get along with their siblings, had never seen violence like this. At home, you had abuse, you had alleged rapes, and just a horrible situation where it said that even at age 4, Catherine was deassociating and kind of blinking out, which I think that, you know, ages, what, like 3 to 10 are some of the most important years of a child's development. That's when they're learning to socialize. That's when they're learning to share and be part of something. So if you have a child that's deassociated at that time, not a good point to have these problems.
By the age of 15, Catherine dropped out of high school. She went to work at the Meatworks, which is where her dad worked, where her brothers worked, her mom had worked there, other relatives. I think her grandfather had worked there.
Yeah, she was barely literate, had really no skills whatsoever. It said that the first time she applied at the slaughterhouse, they didn't hire her. She had to go back a second time before they brought her on, which, wow. I don't know if it was because of her age or what. This place kills 600 cattle a day. And she knew that she wanted to work there because that's where her family worked. She was first brought into the offal room. I call it the offal room. But apparently this is where you scrape the bone marrow and whatnot out of the animals. And this is not the best job. This is kind of the low-end job where they start people out because nobody wants to do it. And that's where she starts. She likes it.
Yeah, she doesn't have a problem working in that room or hearing the cries of the animals that are being put down.
Yeah, she will wander around this slaughterhouse. She will claim that one of her favorite rooms was the pig room, and she'd hang out with the old man in there who would talk about how much he loves killing pigs. And she would just watch him slaughter the pigs. And that's what she wanted to do. And she will eventually be promoted to a boner, where she would receive her own set of knives and she would get to kill some of these animals. Unlike the other people who this is probably more of a job for them. I don't know. Some of them might be weird, but she took pleasure in killing. Others would describe that she would nick an artery to watch the animal bleed out slowly or to hear its screams, whereas others would try to be more efficient with their slaughtering. She's grown up in this abusive home. Her mother has left her father, gotten with another man who is abusive towards her mom. Her mom is now abusing the children. This guy, Ken, that her mom ended up with, it's alleged that he rapes her mother. Catherine will even say that he's raping the children, including her. So we have this completely unstable, abused teen who is now working at a slaughterhouse, shown how to kill, and is being completely desensitized to violence. This doesn't sound like a good combination to me at all.
Well, she was desensitized to violence at home. Let's just make that clear.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I think the only difference was she goes to this slaughterhouse. Death becomes a way of life.
Yeah. Well, there's a comic book called Wanted. The movie's horrible, but the comic book, in it, they actually are creating this perfect assassin, and they have him go work at a slaughterhouse and kill animals to desensitize him. So this is an idea, this theory. And if you work at a slaughterhouse, I'm not trying to pick on you guys. I'm just saying that this is a bad combination for somebody that is already abused and unstable. And I wonder if the comic book Wanted actually pulled Kathleen's story as a source for their idea. At this slaughterhouse, she'll end up meeting a man.
Yeah, David Kellett. He had recently moved to that area, I guess. it wasn't long before they got married. It was said that he had proposed to her one night, probably while he was drunk, and was a little surprised the next day when he found out he was engaged. But they got married. Their first night as a married couple, it was kind of a mixed bag, wasn't it, Justin?
Apparently he didn't perform up to par. And when they started sleeping together, they were just two kids going at it. But their wedding night, he didn't, I guess, deliver what she expected. And after he fell asleep, he would wake up to Kathy strangling him because she was upset that he wasn't performing.
Well, you know how it is, Justin. It's your big day. You have all these expectations of how things will go, you hope. Like her past, she resorted again to violence.
Exactly. David will bring his 18-year-old bride home to meet his family. His sisters and mother, well, at least his sisters, will think that she's okay and get along with her all right. His mother, Florence, thought she was rough around the edges, to put it lightly, I guess. They will go on to describe Kathy's mood swings, how she would go from being very happy, whistling or whatever, to outright disdain and shouting. They also make mention of how strong she was. And I can just imagine if she's working in a slaughterhouse, she's on her feet all day. She's working. She's probably got very callous hands and can take people in a fight. David will tell his family, especially his sister who was staying with him at the time, if she gets cranky, get out of her way. Because once she picks up a knife, it's already too late. This isn't a good start to a marriage.
So the year is 1976. It's May. Catherine gives birth to a baby named Melissa.
She is 20 years old now.
And it's just about a couple months later when David is heading out. He's gone because Catherine attacked him with a broken bottle.
Ouch.
So again, with the violence, again, with the anger, the outrage, this guy is just like, I'm done. But is he really done?
Well, he gets another girlfriend, which, you know, I get it. He's trying to leave. He's trying to get out of this abusive situation. He finds another woman. But, oh, this doesn't go over well. He moves out and he moves to Queensland to live with this woman. And this drives Catherine just mad. She is just not taking this well. She obsessed over this infidelity. She obsessed over him leaving her because she's lost control. There's an incident where she's walking down the street pushing the baby carriage with Melissa in it, and she's shoving it around and screaming. Witnesses say she looks disheveled. She ends up threatening to push the carriage into traffic, and some people call the police. They come and get her, take her baby away, and they end up admitting her into St. Elmo's Psychiatric Hospital, where she's treated and given antidepressants. She's there for a couple weeks, and then she's released, and she goes back home. She gets Melissa, her baby, back, and Melissa is 12 weeks old, and she's, again, having this meltdown, having this breakdown. And what does she do with her 12-week-old baby?
Well, she walks her out to the railroad tracks, places her down on them, and then just walks away. It's a frightening thing because a train is due through there soon. And luckily, there's a woman at a nearby service station.
It's like a shop, yeah.
Yeah, at a nearby convenience store. And she sees what's going on. And so does a man. A man finds out what's going on.
Ted Abraham, yeah.
He runs right over and gets the baby. This is a frightening thing because obviously Catherine is, her mental state is such that she cannot care for her children. They are in constant danger, either through her not taking care of them or placing them directly into danger.
And I think this is revenge towards David too. Like, oh, here's our child. I'm going to kill it.
That's horrible to think about, because David left. He left his child with this woman he was afraid of.
Yeah.
I guess he's assuming, well, she won't harm the baby. She'll just want to harm me. But as we know now, Catherine doesn't really care what your age is or who you are. If she's angry, someone's going to get hurt.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
So after she leaves this baby on the railroad track, she walks down the street into a backyard. She grabs an axe out of the backyard, and I guess she's in the front yard or in the street swinging this axe around, threatening people. And she just left her baby on the railroad tracks. So police, once again, show up, and once again, they don't charge her with any crime. They just take her to the psychiatric hospital where she is checked in. How long does she stay there?
Well, she's only there probably for hours. But the thing here is, we've always said it. If someone needs help, they should get help. And I think the police are trying their best in this situation to help Catherine.
And I
understand they could charge her. Yeah. They definitely could charge her. And I have no problem with that. But maybe they are trying to do the right thing here.
I get that she is going to a hospital, and I actually prefer that she's going to a hospital to get help, but without a paper trail, if and when she actually goes to a court, they have nothing. They have no history on her. So this is my problem with that. She's out of this hospital less than a day. She's out back on the street. This is kind of a scary situation. And she has her baby, Melissa, back. What does she do next?
Well, next, she heads over to a neighbor's house, knocks on the door, and informs them that her baby's ill and she needs to go to the hospital. And so the mom and her children are going to drive Catherine to the hospital.
So they follow Catherine back to her house to retrieve Melissa, the child, right?
Yeah, the teenage daughter goes in with Catherine. But it's not long after she enters the house that Catherine is coming after her with a knife, and she's chasing her, and she cuts her in the face.
I mean, these people did nothing to her who were trying to help her. They've done nothing to her, and she's attacking them. This is how unstable she is. And yet, I've just explained to you, she's gone to this hospital several times and they release her. I'm sure she's probably acting or behaving as if she's normal and getting released because she's able to manipulate. She's able to lie. So she slashes the daughter in the face with a knife. And then what happens?
Well, the family fears for their lives. Catherine essentially takes them hostage and demands that they drive her somewhere. She wants to be driven to her husband's mother's house.
Florence.
Yeah, Florence Kellett's house. She has a plan there. Luckily, the mother decides she's going to try manipulating Catherine because she doesn't want anything else terrible to happen. And so she says, we need to stop at this service station to let out one of my sons because he's got asthma.
Yeah, he's asthmatic.
And we can't take the risk. And so they stop in there and the son gets let out. Well, luckily, he's heading off to go inform the authorities. He's going to go get someone's attention and say, hey, the police need to come here.
And the service station attendee and the mother stall for time until law enforcement come. And then law enforcement and the service station attendee have to pretty much subdue Kathy, who's wielding a knife.
Remember, she's crazy strong.
Yeah. So David hears about the situation with the baby on the railroad tracks and Kathy getting institutionalized over and over again. So he comes back and gets his mother, Florence, and they go to Kathy's mother's house to retrieve the baby. And they pull up in the driveway and he's sitting in the car. Kathy's mother, Barbara, comes storming out of the house, reaches in through the car window, and starts choking David, trying to kill him. This isn't like, oh, I'm mad at you and I'm just shaking you. No, she is choking him. And he's turning blue and he's not fighting back. And Florence is in the back seat, freaking out because she doesn't understand what's happening. And this is the second time she's ever met Kathy's family, or even Kathy, really, for that matter.
Yeah, it's really just a contrast of two families.
Oh, yeah.
David's family, they're just, I guess you could call them normal.
Yeah. Yeah. The mother is strangling David. What happens next?
Well, a hero comes along. Well, not really.
Yeah.
Catherine comes along and punches her mother.
Knocks her to the ground. I think knocks her out cold.
Seriously, just cold cocks her mom. And then do you think that's why they get back together? Because they go back together.
I think David's trying to protect his daughter. I think he's trying to salvage something here for the children. But I don't know.
Let's take a moment here because we haven't really addressed it so far. But you and I had this discussion earlier before we started recording. You know, and I had said, Justin, here's the question. Why do these men go back to Catherine when she has displayed horrible, dangerous behavior?
Well, and most of the time you hear about it from a woman's perspective, where the woman is being beaten by the husband, the woman is being abused by the husband, and it breaks down their self-esteem. It breaks down everything about their personality. And they can try leaving over and over, but the abuser will keep pulling them back, keep manipulating them, tell them they're not good enough to leave, tell them that they can't make it on their own, or hold something over them, hold on to an item, whatever it is, a child, to get them to come back. And David wants to leave, but he just can't. I mean, he got away for a little bit. He got a new girlfriend. That didn't work out. The girlfriend left him. So now he's back in this situation trying to look out for his child, Melissa. David is back in her life. Weeks later, they will end up moving, relocating, so David can get a job. He ends up driving trucks, and there's a coal mine and whatnot. So a lot of her relationships will be guys that drive trucks and work in the coal mine. David will actually organize a surprise birthday party for Kathy. And He invites the whole family. And this is maybe one of the few times in their relationship where everything goes well and Kathy's actually happy. But it's at the same time where Kathy has become obsessed with death, with knives. She's actually taken this collection of knives from the slaughterhouse and she hung it above the bed. When she's asked about this collection of knives and why they're above the bed, she says, they're there in case I need them. There's a situation where one of David's sisters is staying with them and hears Melissa, the child, crying. And she goes upstairs into the bathroom and finds Kathy has turned on the hot water and is scolding the child. They get help, but again, they're not reporting this to authorities. And it's around 1979-ish where Kathy will actually start having an affair on David, cheating on him, and she'll get caught. So at this point, they pick up and move again. I feel like they're moving to start anew, or they're just trying to restart their lives. But no matter where you move, there you are.
They're bringing their troubles with them.
Oh, absolutely.
And you said no one was reporting these things, you know, like burning the child in the water. I think it was because they were afraid of Catherine. They were afraid of, if we start trouble with her, then she might really take it to the extreme and someone might die.
Kathy will end up getting pregnant with a second child. And this doesn't go well, as you could imagine. She's very emotional and having trouble coping with this situation. And I guess David was into playing darts. He's out at the pub one night. And he's in a tournament, and he's about to win. But he was supposed to be home an hour ago or whatever. So he gets home late that night, and he walks in through the door to tell Kathy, hey, I won at darts. Yay for me, right? He doesn't see Kathy, but he feels something hit him in the back of the head. And Kathy was lying in wait for him to get home with an iron skillet. And she tried to cave in his head with it when he walked through the front door. He will drag himself to the neighbor's house to call for help. Meanwhile, she's taken all of his clothing and a lot of his possessions and put it in the bathtub and set them on fire. Police come. They ask, David, do you want to press charges? And he says, no, I don't want to press charges because if I do, then I don't know what she's going to do. You know, we have these two children now.
Yeah, and that's what I had said earlier. It's this idea that she's dangerous. People are going to be hurt. But as long as we don't push this too much, as long as we don't involve the authorities here, maybe no one will die. I mean, that's saying something. It speaks to how dangerous this person was, this, you know, Catherine Knight.
He stays with her. Again, I can't blame him for his actions. He doesn't deserve what he's getting. He's trying his best. He's a truck driver. He's out on the road a lot. She's getting more and more paranoid now that he is cheating on her. And she thinks that every truck driver out there has a woman on the side. So she starts threatening him. And she has these knives. So he's getting more and more afraid of her. And she's lashing out and just being out of control. He's pretty much separated from her. Like I said, she was cheating on him earlier. It didn't go over well. But they're able to make enough of a break where Kathy will end up meeting a new man named Dave Saunders. He worked in the coal mine. And he was into racing these weird off-road cars. I don't know what they're called, but it's off-road racing. He was a manly guy. He liked to drink at the pub, you know, worked at the mine. Everyone in this town is kind of in this same sort of culture. I'm not going to diss the town, but it's a factory town. Everybody works in the coal mine. Everyone works at the factory, and it's kind of simple. So there's a lot of drinking. There's a lot of drug abuse. And sadly, there's a lot of domestic abuse in this town. Dave Saunders was a nice guy, and he owned a dingo, which is a dog, for anyone that doesn't know. And he will end up moving into Catherine's house. As usual, things are going well in the beginning, but they go downhill fast. And Dave will end up coming home late. And remember, David came home late and he had his head caved in with an iron skillet. Well, when Saunders comes home late, I think this is a little bit more vicious, but Kathy will take his dog and slit its throat in front of Saunders to show him this is what happens when you don't do as you're told. After she kills his dog, she will attack him and end up breaking some of his ribs and inflicting some deep cuts into his wrists, which I'm assuming are pretty much defensive wounds because she's trying to stab him. Then she'll do a half-hearted attempt to overdose herself with sleeping pills, and this lands her back at the psychiatric hospital. She will go on to her sister's house with a shotgun and proclaim that she has killed Saunders, which she hasn't. She's just saying these things. And she seems to be getting off on the reactions of people. She gets off on horrifying them, saying these outlandish things to them, along with actually doing things that are horrifying and watching their reactions. Dave Saunders will try to leave her several times, but in 1988, they'll end up having a daughter together.
Once again, it's despite the violence that's going on, there's still an ongoing relationship. It wasn't like she begged them to come back.
Yeah.
Because she was the one in power. She was the one that had control. Or at least that's how she saw it.
He will end up taking a extended leave from work and telling Kathy that he's going to visit some friends in another town, but he's actually planning his escape, and he will leave Catherine without his daughter.
Again, I think it's just she'll take care of the daughter. She'll be okay, but she hates me, so I need to go.
Kathy will be so upset with this situation that she will end up telling the daughter, "Your father's dead." She's telling a child that your dad's gone. Sorry about it. And she's taking gleeful joy in seeing the daughter's reaction, knowing that her father's not coming home. At this point, it's 1990 to 1993. She will end up meeting a man named John Chillingsworth. They will have a son together named Eric in 1991. Her relationship with John will pretty much play out the same way as her relationship with all these other men.
And again, she was always jealous, or she would fly into rages over things, things that weren't even true. She would just hear stuff or believe things, and then she would take them out on her partner. And some of the things that she did to John were she smashed his glasses. She also smashed his false teeth. You know, this is just like the other ones. The guy was kind of a drinker, and she abused him, and eventually the guy ends up leaving. It's the same pattern that plays out regularly with Catherine over the years with each of her partners. Now it's man number four where we come to what I would say is the meat of the story. The reason why Catherine Knight is so infamous is because of her relationship and how it ends with this man named John Price, known as Pricey.
John Price, again, he drove trucks, worked in the mine, drank a lot. She has a type.
Yeah, she does have a type. And what I found interesting about John, and maybe this isn't unique, I don't know because I'm not this kind of a drinker, but He was literally an alcoholic that would drink all night, and then he would still be the first guy at work.
Every day.
So, hey, he has a work ethic.
John had separated from his wife, Colleen, years before. He had two daughters from this marriage. And again, the two daughters met Kathy, and at first, actually got along with her. Thought she was a nice woman. But over time of hanging out with her, they could see, I guess, the cracks. They could see the behavior. And one of them would describe driving in a car with Catherine down the road, and a dog would run across the road, and she would actually swerve the car to hit the dog. And when asked about this, she just said, "I don't like dogs." Well, I think back to Saunders Dingo, and the slaughterhouse and all these other issues. And now she has this hatred for animals.
Yeah, when she was young, supposedly she loved animals. But again, she's become unstable. She's had this terrible life as she grew up. And so she's developed a completely different state of mind here. So there is no love of animals anymore. Things just annoy her.
She will end up stabbing and abusing John over time. He will have wounds on his body just repeatedly from her. He will tell his coworkers, like, "Yeah, my wife did that. The scar right here, that's where she stabbed me." And is struggling at work because, not because he's drinking, but because he's bleeding from a stab wound or some sort of injury that's been inflicted by her. She will want John Price to marry her. She wants to settle down with him. Maybe John saw the red flags. Maybe he's just not a marrying type of guy, but he will turn down Kathy's proposal.
It's like he didn't really want to leave her, but he didn't want to marry her. He was fine with where things were at, where if they had a blow up, then yeah, they would deal. But he was not going to settle down with her, even with all of her pressure.
She doesn't take no well, as you can imagine. She will end up sitting down his daughter, Rebecca, and telling her, she's 13 years old, and telling her that her father isn't really her father, and that her mother had slept around, and that John is just the guy that's taking care of her. So she's pretty much telling Rebecca, like, "Your whole life is a lie, and everything your parents tell you is a lie. This isn't working out." So she's dividing the family, manipulating, lying.
So then the next big fight is about the titling of Price's home. It was in the name of his kids. Well, she wanted her name on it. She claimed that since they were basically living as partners, she should have a claim on it. Well, he refused to change the title. After all, he wasn't going to marry her, and he didn't really want her to have his stuff either. He just wanted a partner. They got into a big fight.
Because he won't add her name to the title of the house, she demands $10,000 or some obscene amount of money to be bought out. And of course, he won't give her money either or put her name on the title.
So Catherine, and we didn't really talk about this, but she had a thing for video recording things. She liked to video record stuff.
Yeah.
And in this instance, she went out to a garden shed that was on the property, and she filmed inside of that garden shed. And it just so happened to be, and I think she knows what she's doing, but there's a first aid kit that belonged to the mine where Price worked at that he had taken from the mine, and it's inside this garden shed. She shows it to his boss. He looks at it and says, "Oh, he's a thief." He fires John Price. You know, he's a very good worker, always shows up. He's the first guy there, but he's a thief, and they just can't trust that. So they fire him. So he kicks Catherine out. Now, it has been explained that it was something that was just going to be thrown out. They were just going to end up getting rid of it because it had expired. You know, everything has a date on it. This was going to be tossed, but still, he took it. And so his boss was like, "Nah, he's fired." And she's gone for, I think, about 6 months. But all along the way, she'd been working her way back into a relationship with him, because she wasn't just going to stay away. This wasn't 6 months she was gone, then she came back. No, she kept coming back, trying to talk with him and work on him. And then they get back together.
Well, you know, he's 43 years old. He's unemployed. He doesn't have much going on right now because she's destroyed his life. You talk about her filming things. She was really into horror movies and violent flicks. She also had weird decor around her house. She had like farming equipment, but mainly like sharp tools, like machetes and a scythe and things like that. And she would hang these up on the walls and the ceiling of the house. And then she had taxidermied animals or skulls. And I get it, you know, I've been friends with enough goth people, you know, goth people that are into death, but this is not really an appreciation for death. This is more or less a power trip over life, I would say.
Yeah, it's like, I'm not really bothered by people's decor so much, but if you see someone's decor and you know what their behavior is like and it's frightening, that's when it becomes a worry. I mean, there are some people I've known who have plenty of skulls at their house, and I'm not worried at all.
No.
But Catherine Knight, that's a whole different story. February 17th, 2000, there was a nasty fight between John Price and Catherine Knight. Price ended up going to a neighbor's house and told them what was going on. He called the police. Now, he said that Catherine was threatening him with a knife, and she claimed that he had attacked her. Well, in the end, he was asking for the police to remove her from the house. It wasn't her house. Her name's not on the title. They're not married. But the police said they couldn't do it since she essentially lived there.
Sort of a common law wife in a sense, or a squatter's rights.
Now that I wonder about. Yeah, squatter. Well, she's been there.
Yeah.
Seems like a weak excuse, but...
Well, and he goes on to try to get a restraining order or order of protection. Not sure what they call it in Australia.
In Australia, it's an apprehended domestic violence order.
Ah, but this is going to take weeks for him to get. He can't get a court date anytime soon. At work, he's showing his injuries to his coworkers. They're telling him, don't go home. Stay at a hotel. Stay with us. He says he has to go home because his children are there and he has to protect his children.
He had gone to the courthouse. He had told the police what was going on, let them know about Catherine's behavior. He also let his friends know, hey, if I don't show up for work the next day, then I'm dead and Catherine's killed me. So because of the fight on the 27th, Catherine goes to a doctor to have her bruises recorded, you know, so there's a record of what happened to her.
She's documenting her injuries to claim that this is her being the victim.
Yeah, there were finger-like bruises on her right breast, and there was a, you know, a faint bruise on her left jaw. And she also showed there were bruises to other people in her life as evidence that John Price was abusing her. And this is on the same day that John Price is taking out an apprehended violence order against her. So it's becoming he said, she said. And a lot of times when there's domestic violence, you know, I think like the going idea is it's usually the man is abusing his wife or his partner.
It's what we expect in this situation. And she's able to manipulate and try to steer things in her favor.
Catherine arranges for her oldest daughter to keep an eye on the kids, not just her younger kids, but also John Price's two kids. So they're going for a sleepover, and then Catherine heads back to Price's house. Price was out with the neighbors after work, and then he came home, and he got into bed at about 11 o'clock that night. Catherine went and took a shower, and then dressed into some lingerie, and then...
woke him up, seduced him.
Yeah, seduced him, and then after they were finished, John Price kind of settles back down, and he's going to go to sleep, only it's not long before he gets a rude awakening.
She attacks him when he's half asleep.
She starts stabbing him with this boning knife. She follows him because he tries to leave. He goes down the hallway. He's trying to leave the residence.
He's trying to escape.
And she's stabbing him all the way throughout the house, all the way to the door where he's trying to go out. And she's yanking him back in, stabbing him. It's a total of 37 times that she stabs him. And then that's the terrifying part because he's alive. But after he's dead, this just gets grotesque.
She will end up beheading and skinning him. She will take his skin and put it on a meat hook and hang it up because she has all this weird farm equipment and sharp objects around the house to do whatever she wants with.
After she murdered John, she took his wallet, using his bank card, made two withdrawals, each for $500, and they never found that money. So we don't know what she did with it, but they never found it.
She hid it. So this has gone from a domestic violence attack of her typical stabbing to full-on murder. And then that next level of just horrific grotesqueness. She will take his head and what does she do next, Aaron?
His head is placed into a pot to be boiled, and parts of John are cut up and cooked with vegetables, and then some parts of him are fed to the dog. Now, she's cooking. She's cooking a meal, and it's for John's children. She actually has places set for each of his kids, and she's planning to serve them, John, with vegetables.
Yeah, but she's taken photos of them and stabbed out their faces and written these just incoherent notes with their names and how, if I can't have your father, then nobody can have him. Just... It's on another level, and now you understand why she's compared to Jeffrey Dahmer and other murderers out there.
It was violence. It was an attack. It was screaming. It was stabbing. And when she skinned him, she went into the same mode she had when she worked at the slaughterhouse. So then she took her time. And it's a frightening thing that when she was actually mutilating him, she actually saw this as like a work of art, is what they said.
When John doesn't show up for work the next day, one, it's out of character for him. Two, he's told his coworkers, if I don't show up, that means I'm dead. He's shown them his injuries. It's pretty quick for them to notify the authorities and have them go do a welfare check on his home. Detective Bob Wells will show up on scene. There's other deputies that were the first responders. He tries to ask them what is inside the house, and he can tell that they're shaken. They're not taking this well. Bob will enter the home, and he will describe what he thought was a wetsuit hanging from a meat hook.
They see the dinner setting. They have a pretty good idea of what happened in the home. This isn't something that requires hours and hours of detective work to figure out what happened. It's pretty apparent.
And they will discover that Catherine is laying in bed asleep.
Well, yeah, she appears asleep. They try to wake her and she's not coming out of sleep real easy.
And there's empty pill packages strewn around the bedroom. It's kind of apparent that she's ODing on some sort of medication and she's completely out of it. They will get her up and take her to the hospital while they document everything that's inside this home. She will be at this hospital for 6 days. News reports will come out about a wife who has murdered her husband. The gory details won't come out right away, but as soon as there's a news report about this, David's family and even Price's family will know who the report's talking about. Sadly, Price's daughter won't have any clue about it until she reads the newspaper and finds out about her father's horrible death. Bob Wells, the lead detective, will be the first one that interviews Catherine. She will claim that she doesn't remember anything from the night. She will have no recollection of the murder or what happened. She will say that she remembers stabbing him previously from months earlier. And she'll be quick to say, oh yeah, we had an argument, we had a fight, and I have bruises to show you that he was attacking me because I'm the victim here and I was defending myself when I stabbed him. So this is how she's spinning it in her first interview with Detective Wells.
There are some stories about my mom's life that I truly never get tired of hearing. Just in time for Mother's Day, I found the perfect gift that captures all her stories for my family forever. It's called Storyworth. Storyworth helps you preserve precious memories and stories from your mom or grandmother for years to come. Each week, Storyworth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question that you get to help pick. What was your favorite toy as a child? Or what's your favorite memory of your grandmother? All your loved one needs to do is respond to that email with a story. After a year of responses, Storyworth compiles your loved one's stories and photos into a beautiful keepsake hardcover book. You can even keep a copy of the book for yourself. My mom completed her story, and each of her kids now has a copy to read and share with their kids. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift you'll cherish for years. Storyworth. Right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/GenY. That's storyworth.com/GenY to save $10 on your first purchase.
Detective Wells will interview the other children, and they will report that Kathy had told them, I'm going to kill Pricey, and I'm going to get away with it, because I'm going to say I'm crazy.
Is she setting this up, or is she telling the truth?
I mean, this is premeditation, but at the same time, she's telling the truth. I mean, both are right.
I know. Sometimes we discuss cases where we say, you know, that guy really seemed crazy, but we know he did this. So there is culpability here, but dang, it's almost like she lives in the crazy and she's okay with it.
Oh, absolutely. It's like a lot of mass shooters or serial killers or whatnot. They are very capable of planning things. They're very capable of executing their mission based on completely wild ideas and delusions. So it's that fine line of, well, you say somebody has lost their grasp on reality, but that doesn't mean they're a raving lunatic. It means that they can't distinguish reality from fantasy, reality from delusion or hallucination, but they're still capable of functioning on a level where, how do you determine if this was done with sound mind and body?
Well, I think judging by the way that she's handled herself, the things that she's done and the things she's said, this is the kind of individual who doesn't get sympathy.
No.
Going out of their way to help her?
She told them what she was going to do. She even went and withdrew money that night. But on the flip side, the way she went about it is not normal. And I wonder if she did it in such a horrific manner that she'd planned to use this incompetence defense, or if she was just that brutal and that, just disgusting in her revenge.
Well, detectives, they can tell that this is a woman who had worked at a slaughterhouse, enjoyed it, and had a fascination with sharp objects. So I'm not sure that anybody would be able to look at this crime and say, yeah, she lost it. No, this is more like she was reveling in what was going on.
Yeah, but you can't say that she was completely of sound mind either. You can't say that she was stone cold sane. That's not applicable here. She's had this, I don't know. I don't know if she's a psychopath or what you want to call her, but she's not sane.
But she's also very, very dangerous.
There's been 100 times where law enforcement and these hospitals and professionals could have checked her, and they didn't. This was completely preventable, but she kept slipping through the cracks, not getting charged, not getting proper medication, not getting supervised, not getting followed up on. This monster was created, and nobody seemed to understand the potential of harm here. I mean, I think they understood it, but nobody could do anything about it.
Well, some didn't act because they were afraid, and some didn't act because there was no follow through.
Absolutely.
Look, this goes to trial. When she had talked to detectives before, one of the things that she made loud and clear was that she didn't really know what happened, but she accepted the fact that she did what she did. So it's kind of an odd thing. She gets the trial, and the people testifying against her do a pretty bang up job. I mean, the psychiatrists come out and they're talking about how this is something she's fantasized about for a long time. That's why she took her time skinning John Price and cooking him. This isn't something that just willy-nilly happened. This was in the planning for a while. And as you said, she had told people that she was going to kill him. So there's not any mystery here.
No.
And they also talked about what likely she was suffering from. One of the things was borderline personality disorder.
And PTSD.
Now, granted, she had a very poor childhood. I mean, that we talked about that. That's nothing to skim over, really, but take our word on it. It was a bad childhood. It likely had something to do with the person she became, which is what you referred to earlier with the nurture. Even her mother attacking David. That's not something that she just did all of a sudden. Her mother was like this as well. Her mother was very violent and went into rages. They also talked about how Catherine wasn't insane. There was talk about how she claimed that there was sexual abuse going on in the home, although there was nothing to substantiate that. But is she lying? I mean, I almost want to say I don't think she is.
I'm willing to believe that because of her outlandish behavior later on in life.
Again, there are factors here. To me, they don't excuse what she did. It's more of an explanation of these are the things that make up Catherine Knight. And during the proceedings of the court, of the trial, Catherine was very, very calm throughout most of it, except when there was testimony about the crime scene by police officers. And they said then she started to clack her teeth and she started rocking back and forth. And she had some outbursts and she needed to be given a sedative after being removed from the courtroom.
She will end up pleading guilty to the crime, which this is a full reversal from I don't know what happened to I was defending myself to yeah, I did this. With a guilty plea, there isn't much discussion anymore and she will be sentenced for her crimes.
November 8th, 2001. Catherine is sentenced.
She is sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And this is the first woman in Australia to be sentenced this way. The judge said it was clear to him that she not only planned the murder, but she also took enjoyment in what she did afterwards.
It's on June 28th, 2006, when Catherine's attorneys appealed her sentencing. You might say, well, how can they do that? I mean, she pled guilty and then she was sentenced. So how do they get here? But they said it was based on the grounds that the sentencing judge was in error when he found the crime to be in the worst class of case, not giving her any kind of leniency or giving her mitigating factors for pleading guilty. Not looking into taking into account her psychiatric disorder, ignoring the fact that she had no prior record, which, again, she did have one of a sort. It's just no one was taking this stuff down. You know what I mean? There wasn't like a criminal record of, gee, she placed her baby on train tracks shortly before a train was due to come through, right? The southbound train.
Yeah.
That's not a crime, apparently, because she wasn't charged with a crime. But seriously, you know, so we're talking legally here. She didn't have a prior record.
It's weird because she didn't have a prior record because she kept falling through the cracks. The system was failing at every turn to check this woman. But at the same time, they're now using this in her favor. If she did have a prior record, they could have said, well, these are mitigating factors. Look at all the problems she had. It's half dozen one, six of the other.
They also point out that her sentence was manifestly excessive. Why? Because she was the first woman ever given a life sentence with no parole.
She skinned a dude alive. How much sympathy can we really have?
So, I mean, they're pointing this out and saying, hey, this is weird. Why are you doing this? So November 9th, 2006, all five parts of the appeal were dismissed. And I mean, I can understand why. They're saying these are special circumstances. This is not your typical murderess. I mean, what do you think, Justin? Right. I mean, they pointed out all these things saying, oh, well, why'd you do this? This is extreme and you're not taking account this. And they're pointing back at this history of violence that she has.
I get why they gave her the most extreme sentence, because she's the first woman in Australia to commit such an extreme crime. So the law is weighing that out. And her defense team is trying to argue mitigating factors. Again, I don't really agree here. This could have been possibly stopped. This could have been prevented if at any point the police would have just said, we're charging her, or we're removing her from the home, or the psychiatric hospital followed up on her treatments. Something court ordered. It was a complete miss.
Yeah, there's this rage to her that reminds me of Eileen Wuornos. Absolutely. When I've read about her case.
Absolutely.
After the trial, after the sentencing, there's more tragedy. John Price's family goes through quite a bit. John's brother, Bob, takes his own life. He had been there for all of the hearings throughout the trial. It seemed as though, and this is just a guess, but maybe hearing about what his brother went through in his last moments, they just really ate at him. Then Price's children continue to suffer after Bob died. They lost their dad. They lost their uncle. And even the media, I guess, in a way to be considerate, they didn't report on this as much as, say, you know, the American media would have.
It was still a circus going on, especially during the trial. But I feel that they somewhat came to their senses after the fact.
Yeah, it got reined in after everything started to settle down. They just reined it in.
I think Price's family and the other families affected might argue with us, because I'm sure they got the brunt of this, but it seems that it wasn't quite as reported on as it would have been in America.
Catherine was sent to the Silverwater Women's Correctional Center. They said she'll be there the rest of her life. The fellow inmates have referred to her as the Nana.
If you look at pictures of her, or if you had run into her on the street, she looks like an ordinary person. She doesn't look like the walking evil that most people would describe her as. She's very unassuming. So I'm not surprised by the fellow inmates calling her Nana, because I'm sure she's a motherly figure to them.
Her behavior in prison has been such that one of the prison officials said, she is no monster, but she'll always be caged like one.
We'd like to thank our sponsor, Third Love. My wife loves her Third Love bra, says it's the most comfortable bra she's ever owned. Go to thirdlove.com/genY now to find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/GENWHY for 15% off today.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.